But you, O Bethlehem of Ephrathah, who are one of the little clans of Judah, from you shall come for me one who is to rule in Israel, whose origin is from of old, from ancient days. Therefore, he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has brought forth. Then the rest of his kindred shall return to the people of Israel. And he shall stand and feed his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they shall live secure, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth. And he shall be the one of peace. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
I dare say, if it weren't for the three wise men, we wouldn't be paying any attention to this brief little passage from the prophet Micah. Micah's book has largely been in the shadows. It's not as big as Isaiah's book and not nearly as poetic. It doesn't bleed like the poignant heart of Jeremiah, nor report the dramatic visions of Ezekiel. It's a thin little scroll kept on the shelf, mostly out of sight. And when you open it and read it, some of this sounds derivative. The prophet repeats what we've heard before. There'll be a time of judgment, gloom and doom, followed by a season of restoration. A lot of biblical prophets talk that way. It's almost like a recurring pattern. Then there's the famous peacemaking passage in the second chapter. Actually, it's the second chapter of Isaiah. They shall beat their swords into plowshares. Nations shall not learn war anymore. Well, Micah lifts that from Isaiah and puts it in chapter 4. I mean, if the sermon is worth preaching once, you might as well preach it again. In the passage we heard today, he repeats a familiar line from Isaiah 40. He shall feed his flock. With which the choir bursts into the Messiah. And he also reminds us that King David, the greatest of Israel's kings, came from Bethlehem, a small village that has never otherwise shined in the glory of Jerusalem. And that's kind of it. Okay, Micah, thank you for your work. We'll roll up the scroll, put it back on the shelf, and wait another 700 years. That is, until the day the knock on the door occurs. And three wise men are standing there at the gate of the palace saying, where's the new king? Where is he, born king of the Jews? We've seen his star at his rising. Well, you may remember that story. King Herod is curious, then threatened, then defiant. What do you mean, you wise guys, he says. I'm the king. What are you talking about? Some new king has been born? These wise men might be pious. They might be noticing heavenly signs out there. But they're also rather vague. They followed a new star across the desert. And as Garrison Keillor once said so famously, the directions you get from a star are rather ambiguous. It's then that Herod turns to the Bible scholars on his staff. You see, every king worth his salt ought to have some Bible scholars on the staff. And these scholars don't even have to thumb through the scrolls. They already know where it is. Micah chapter 5, verse 2. And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means the least of the rulers among Judah, for from you shall come the ruler who is to shepherd his people Israel. And that verse has been sitting on the shelf, hiding in the shadows for 700 years, until the moment the wise men knock on the door to ask, where is the king? The answer, in Bethlehem. And you have every reason to ask, why Bethlehem? Go ahead.
Why Bethlehem?
prophet says, there are three reasons in light of what we know about Jesus. The first is that he is born not only in the hometown of King David, and not only as David's great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchild, but in the tradition of David. David was the king, the great king. He was the best king that anybody could ever remember. And he was around 300 years before Micah even wrote his book, which made it 1,000 years before Jesus. But I tell you, people in the Middle East have long memories. In all those years between, there were an awful lot of kings. Let's take that literally. There were a lot of kings, and they were awful. Well, there were a couple that were okay. Solomon built the temple, although he had too many girlfriends. Josiah was a great reformer, but the king before him was an idiot, and the one who followed was a nincompoop. And when you have terrible national leadership, you grow accustomed to inconsistencies, erratic behavior, and outright brutality. And after a while, you start longing for the best thing you can remember. And it was David. Strong, good-looking, virile, fully human David. A little bit rowdy, and certainly playful. But he brought people together. He was a builder. The nation flourished. And so that's the first reason for Bethlehem. We want somebody like King David. Second is due to a recurring theme in the Jewish scriptures. It goes like this. The little guy will rule over the big guy. As you recall, David was the eighth and the last and youngest son of Jesse. He was the littlest, and he became the king. That's like Joseph, who was almost the youngest son of Jacob, who dreamed of his older brothers bowing down before him. Or Jacob himself, the younger of the twins who swindled his older brother Esau out of the blessing. That's a theme that comes up over and over again in the Bible. It's how Israel, the nation, began to understand itself in the world. We are the little guys. We are strong because we're small. We are small, but we are mighty. Reminder that God doesn't always pick the loud ones, the arrogant ones, the big ones, the pushy and obnoxious ones. God says, oh, you little Bethlehem, the smallest clans of Judah. The inference is that the Messiah will come from a little town, a small town with a great memory but not much of a future. So there's that too. And third, Micah is looking forward to Jesus himself. He can't name him yet, but he knows that whoever is coming will not be flashy but hidden in the hills, living among the peasants. He will be the king, but he will certainly not be born in a palace. He will tend the flock with special attention to the weakest and the most broken. And when Jesus comes, he'll be known as healer. And when Jesus speaks, he will turn the world's values upside down. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Not the mighty, but the meek. And the key to understanding all this, understanding the authority of the Messiah, is his gentleness, which is exactly why he is passed by and so misunderstood. When the Messiah rules, he will not stand on tiptoe, bearing down and further oppressing the people. He will be on the flat soles of his feet as a shepherd among the flock. That's what Micah can see. As the Bible scholars will later point out, centuries later, this little poem is a lampoon on every misdirected human ambition. The prophet is poking fun at Jerusalem, the golden city, which in his time had gotten to be quite tarnished. And he's joking about Assyria, the dominating world empire of his day, by saying God's new king will be born in a humble little town. The king will be a shepherd like David, but he will be surprisingly free from imperial ambition. He will rule over his people, but he will never exploit them or make them afraid. Rather, he'll wait until they're ready for him, and his scepter shall be his compassion. Now, this is difficult still for many people to understand. Three wise men didn't get it. They could not know it apart from the revelation from the prophet Micah. King Herod simply didn't get it either, ruling in obnoxiousness stoked by his own paranoia. Even the Bible scholars on the king's staff couldn't imagine what this might ever look like. They had the text in Micah's old scroll, but they had lived through century after century of nothing happening until Jesus is born. And those who saw him, who heard him, who loved him, who could recognize that he is the one that they've been waiting for. Anybody here still waiting for him? Because as you know, the point of all this is not Bethlehem, but the one who was born there. Which reminds me of a story. In 1865, the greatest preacher of Philadelphia took a year off. He was 30 years old, but worn out, needed to take a break. His name was Phillips Brooks. He was 6 feet, 6 inches tall, and his reputation even taller. He'd been a strong friend of Abraham Lincoln, now assassinated. And already a renowned preacher, he had preached a sermon at Harvard University, at the end of the Civil War, that was so good it was printed and distributed around the nation. But he was worn out, and he needed a breather. That December, he found himself on horseback in the Holy Land. And on Christmas Eve, thinking this might be kind of fun, he rode across the hills, 7 miles from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, past the fields where the shepherds had heard the angels announcing the birth of the Savior. As the village came into view, he stopped his horse and took it all in. It was quiet, it was peaceful, it was sharp contrast to the 4 violent years of civil war and the death of Lincoln. The moment was seared in his heart forever. And 3 years later at Christmas, back in Philadelphia, 150 years ago tomorrow, the memory of Bethlehem was still as clear as a bell. So for the children of his Sunday school, Brooks wrote 5 stanzas of verse, and then he gave his poem to the church organist, Lewis Redner, who quickly imagined a fitting melody already completely harmonized, came out of the oven completely baked. And the result was the Christmas carol that we're going to sing in a few minutes. I think you know it. O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. Yet in thy dark street shineth the everlasting light. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. As I said, there are 5 stanzas, although 4 only make it into the hymnal. And I think it's the forgotten stanza, the one left out, that may be the most poignant. So let me give it to you. Where children pure and happy pray to the blessed child, where misery cries out to thee, son of the mother mild, where charity stands watching and faith holds wide the door. The dark night wakes, the glory breaks, and Christmas comes once more. Isn't that what we want? For Christmas to come again, for the Messiah to come among us, for Christ to be born in us today. It's the kind of Christmas for which the prophet Micah dreamed. He shall stand and feed his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. They shall live secure, for now he shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be the one of peace. This is the promise for you and for me, which by faith we find completed in the birth of Jesus. No ear can hear his coming, but in this world of sin, where meek souls will receive him still, the dear Christ enters in. I pray you have a blessed Christmas.